Okay, well, thank you, and thank you for inviting me here. It's really exciting. To say I feel a little less comfortable than I usually do speaking, because I, you know, like many people in the room, I'm trained as a theoretical physicist, and I sort of still view myself as a physicist puttering around with these biological systems. So sort of lecture as an expert on mammalian development or stem cells or something feels not quite right to me, but I'll do the best I can anyway. So, of course, please continue to interrupt when things don't make sense or are unclear or just wrong. So this first slide shows the sort of equivalence that I'm very excited about. On the left is a schematic of the human embryo at gastrulation stages with various cell types color-coded in different colors, and I'll get into this more a little later. And on the right is a human embryonic stem cell colony where the color code is roughly preserved. So you can see that the equivalence, of course, is not perfect, but we sort of have the right cell types and some sort of organization. And so I'm very excited about using these kinds of systems to understand what's going on here. And I guess I should say that my experience in coming to the system was sort of the exact opposite of what Andy Oates described this morning, where he got to the lab and they were doing cell culture, and he said, oh, you're never going to understand this by using culture cells. We've got to use embryos. So I came to Ali Brievenlew's lab at Rockefeller, and they were working with frogs, and the frog was really daunting to me. And eventually I thought to myself, oh, we're never going to understand this in the embryo. We've got to have something simpler like these culture cells. And so I should be careful, because I've gotten some pretty scathing reviews on recent review articles that I've read. I'm not saying that we shouldn't study embryos. I'm saying that we can add a lot to our study of embryos by these kinds of stem cell systems that are a lot more controllable and manipulatable and observable, especially for mammalian systems, especially for the human system, where, you know, we can make these kind of schematics, but you're never going to see the kind of beautiful movies that Andy showed us in the human system, obviously. And so for that system, we really have to work with what we have. But even in other systems, I think there are advantages to cell culture that you just can't access in embryos, really in any embryos. And hopefully I'll get into some of that today. Okay, so I'd like to sort of do this in two parts. I'm going to briefly review early mammalian development from fertilization through the blastocyst stage, and then talk in some more detail about gastrulation and what is thought about how gastrulation works. And then I'm really going to highlight what I think are just some very basic puzzles about gastrulation that, despite all the progress we've made, despite all we know about gastrulation in these systems, there's some very basic things that we don't know that I hope we can figure out using stem cells. And then I'm going to tell you about stem cells, different types of stem cells, and their basic properties in terms of, you know, the molecular things you need to grow them and to differentiate them, and talk briefly about sort of relatively recent advances in being able to turn all kinds of cells into stem cells, which is obviously very exciting to medical people and other people. And then I'll sort of close briefly talking about the use of stem cells for studying development, but this is really sort of more a teaser for my talk next week, where I'll get into this in a lot more detail. Okay, so in contrast to, the organisms that you've talked about so far, early mammalian development is, of course, quite a bit different, and the most obvious difference is that it takes place in utero. So the fertilization takes place in this fallopian tube, and then the fertilized embryo travels down this fallopian tube, dividing as it's going down. This is a relatively slow process, right? So in contrast to the early zebrafish embryo or the early frog embryo, where you have these cleavages happening every 20 minutes, 30 minutes, something like that, right? These cleavages are happening every 12 to 24 hours as the embryo travels down. And the embryo will then, when it arrives in the uterus, right before the gastrulation stage, it will implant in the wall of the uterus and then undergo this gastrulation process. Okay, so to zoom in on these very early stages, right, so as I said, these are quite a bit different from the early stages of the other kinds of embryos we've been thinking about, so they're slow. I don't know whether anyone has talked about a sort of mid-blastula transition type event, but in fish and frog, right, you go up to gastrulation, and basically there's been no transcription in the embryo prior to that stage. And that means that the maternal deposition of a lot of these things is really crucial for the embryo, and right in, you know, flies with bicoid and in the frog with the deposition of maternal transcripts that define the vegetal pole and then the dorsal side, right, a lot of the sort of pattern is established through a pre-pattern that's deposited by the mother. So a sort of really signature feature of mammalian development is that there's none of that pre-pattern, right? So the genome is activated very early in development. People still kind of I think argue exactly about this, but somewhere between 1 and 8 cells, and it might depend on the species you're looking at. So mouse and human differ slightly here. And really all these cells at this stage, right, so here are early mammalian embryo cells dividing. All the cells at this stage are basically equivalent, right? So there's no pattern here, right? And you can, they're sort of just growing to generate some mass. And you can even pluck off one of these cells, and the embryo will regenerate, and it will be fine, right? That's the basis for a lot of this. If people want to test their embryos in the IVF clinic for whatever disorder, right, you can take material from the embryo, and it doesn't harm the embryo at all. Really, that much can't be said for most of the other model organisms. And so what I think is kind of exciting about this from a physicist's perspective is that the pattern that's generated is really sort of a self-organized pattern. And so we've sort of been fascinated by understanding how do these systems grow and then make these patterns without really any cues, right? It's just some system that gets bigger and bigger and bigger, making copies of itself, and then starts to make decisions, making the cells different, making these patterns. And so how does that work? Okay, so let's proceed a little further into pre-gastrulation development. So after you have a series of divisions that takes one cell to 8 and they all sort of look the same, you start to get cells making the earliest self-fate decisions. And the first decisions that you get are between the what's called the inner cell mass, shown here, and the extra embryonic tissue, which will go on to form the placenta, which is labeled TE for trophectoderm. And these cells initially are sort of mixed together spatially in a sort of not quite pattern, and then segregate out so that the trophectoderm surrounds and the inner cell mass is here. And there's this process is sort of recapitulated molecularly, wherein right, these transcription factors that define these states first overlap and are co-expressed and then become mutually exclusive, and then the expression sorts out into these different levels. And so this inner cell mass is what goes on to form the embryo proper, but it also still generates other extraembryonic tissues, so there's a second self-fate decision within the inner cell mass that is regulated by two different transcription factors, GATA6 and NANOG, but the sort of rough story is similar, right? You have these things, the expression of them becomes speckled and mixed, and then the sort of lump of tissue in here separates into the epiblast, which is now what will go on to generate the embryo proper. And still actually will generate some extra embryonic lineages as well, and the primitive endoderm, which was primarily thought to be an extra embryonic tissue, although recent work has actually shown that it mixes with the endoderm and ends up in the gut of the embryo, some of these cells. So the sort of strict division that this is embryonic and this is extra embryonic has been shown not to be true, but roughly speaking, almost all of the embryo comes through this epiblast, and these green and blue tissues are extraembryonic tissues, and the extraembryonic tissues are important for a couple of things. So one, of course, is that the blue cells here, guide this implantation into the uterus and the exchange nutrients with the mother. So that's another crucial difference between these kinds of embryos and the, frog and fish embryos, is that in those embryos, right, you can Ali Brivenlu, whose lab I was in, liked to say that the culture media for the frog embryo is pond water. So you can't culture mammalian embryos in pond water, right? They need to get nutrition from the mother or from their culture media. And so these cells mediate some of that. And as I'll get into, they're also absolutely crucial for supplying signals to this epiblast that pattern this epiblast. So you by generating this sort of arrangement of cell fates, right, you've sort of created, even though the epiblast itself, which will generate the embryo, sort of looks homogeneous, you've created the possibility of patterning by having different signals emerge from the blue extraembryonic cells versus the green extraembryonic cells, and that's exactly what happens. Okay, so what I just said is sort of summarized here, right? You start with this blastocyst. It divides between the inner cell mass and the trophoblast. The inner cell mass then divides between the epiblast and this primitive endoderm, which is also called the hypoblast. And then sort of what I'm really interested in is this process by which the epiblast generates all the embryonic tissues. So there's a gastrulation process that I'll get to in a minute that makes a site of gastrulation, which is called the primitive streak in mammalian embryos. And the endoderm and mesoderm come from the primitive streak. And the cells that are in the epiblast that end up not going through the primitive streak, these cells stay and become the ectoderm. So this pluripotent cell fate sort of seamlessly transitions to the ectoderm if it doesn't go through this inducing region, the primitive streak, that makes endoderm and mesoderm. And as you can see, right, as I said, this division where the epiblast generates the embryo and the hypoblast or primitive endoderm is extraembryonic is not perfect because there are cells that will go from the epiblast to here, and then there's even cells that will proceed through the primitive streak. They actually make something that looks like mesoderm, but then that mesoderm migrates away from the embryo and joins with the extraembryonic tissue. So this epiblast is contributing to what they call the extraembryonic mesoderm. And it's not shown here, but some of this extraembryonic endoderm will actually end up inside the embryo proper. Okay, so I don't know whether anyone sort of talked in detail about gastrulation yet, but so I like to show this movie from David Chuck and Ray Keller's lab. Did you guys see this movie already? Okay, yeah, so this is a DIC image of a frog embryo gastrulating, and this is sort of how I was introduced to gastrulation. And so what you see are the endoderm and mesoderm involuting into the embryo at this blastopore lip, which is a site of gastrulation, and then it goes sort of into the process of neurulation. So this is the neural tube forming along the back of the embryo, and the neural tube closing, and then the head is forming up here with the eyes. When I first started studying development and I thought about the frog, I kind of always thought about gastrulation as the process by which the tissues that belong on the inside of the embryo end up on the inside of the embryo. But it turns out that in mammals, that's totally wrong, actually. It's sort of the process by which the tissues belong on the inside of the embryo actually end up on the outside of the embryo. And then the whole thing has to flip around. So it makes mammalian development kind of confusing. And so I think the better way to think about gastrulation is it's a way of taking this sort of one layer of more uniform tissue and turning it into the three layers of the embryo. So the ectoderm, the mesoderm, and the endoderm. The mesoderm and the endoderm are the tissues that go through this streak-like region, and the ectoderm is the tissue that sort of covers the outside that does not. But in the mammalian embryo, right, let's see what my next picture is. Yeah. Okay, so this, in the mammalian embryo, the direction is sort of opposite, right? So you have this epiblast, and this is your pluripotent cells, and they're colored red here. And then instead of being a circular lip on the bottom of the embryo, your site of gastrulation is, as I said, a streak. So it's basically a line down this side of the embryo. And the cells leave this inner tissue, this epiblast, and start migrating. This blue tissue is all this extraembryonic tissue that's surrounding it. So if I imagine peeling away this extraembryonic tissue, and looking at what's going on at this site of gastrulation, you have these cells that were once red involuting and then moving outside and migrating. And so they make here, right, mesoderm is colored in green and endoderm in yellow, and the stuff that's going to go on to form the ectoderm is red. And so, like I said, this makes a backwards pattern, right? Your ectoderm, which you think of as surface, ends up on the inside, the mesoderm in between, and the endoderm covering around the outside. And then at a later stage, which I'm not really going to talk about, in a process called turning, this thing actually sort of flips this cup around. There is, in addition to the sort of cell fate decisions that are happening in this streak, there's also epithelial to mesenchymal transition that's happening. And so there's all kinds of physical stuff going in here. So this is an electron microscopy image where you can imagine you're sort of looking down at this ring, right, and you're looking at this section of the ring. So these nicely organized sort of epithelial looking cells, or the epiblast layer of cells, and make this nice epithelium. And then this is the site of the primitive streak, where you see these cells are sort of leaving the epithelium. They move outward, and you see these migrating cells, which look a lot more mesenchymal. Yeah?
So where would be apical and basal for the epithelium?
Okay, so the primitive, apical and basal would, the apical side is inside, and the basal side is outside. These cells are polarized, and they may actually affect like localization of receptors and how they can respond to signals and stuff like that. So they undergo this EMT transition, and they just sort of migrate. Now I'd like to sort of briefly tell you a sort of story, which in my view is sort of the current model of how this gastrulation works in the mouse and sort of by extension the mammalian embryo, which is obviously based on many, many years of work. If anyone is interested in reading on this in more detail, this review article from Liz Robertson's lab I think is really excellent. And you know, Liz Robertson has done a lot of this work in her own lab.
Actually, is not gastrulation actually different between mouse and
It is. It depends what you mean by different.
In terms of morphology.
Yes, it's quite different. So, coming to this a little. Yeah, so the human looks more like the chick, right? If you're familiar with that, and that you have this. So if you imagine taking this cup-shaped thing and just cutting it and flattening it out, you get some approximation to the human embryo, right? This sort of streak, which goes down the side, now becomes sort of a radial line from the edge to the center of the embryo. And then these migrations, which happen around the edge, are actually happening sort of in the plane, leaving this streak and migrating. And so the, I don't know, there's a place that I can write that people can see. But, right, so in the mouse, you have this sort of cup, right, and posterior is here, and anterior is here, and this is the streak. And the cells kind of migrate in these curved arrows. If I imagine flattening this cup into a circle, right, I have this streak where posterior is on this side and anterior is on this side, and they sort of migrate in the plane. So there is, people have, there's some older literature. Richard Berenger, who's my neighbor in Houston, he wrote a paper maybe 15 years ago or something called Flattening the Mouse Embryo, where he tries to discuss the equivalence between the mouse and the human embryo. So yeah, I think if you're interested in sort of morphology, mechanics, there's obviously a lot that's different. But there is some sort of, you know, topological mapping between these things, and certainly the molecular signals are very well. Unfortunately, the bottom line is, you know, we know something about the shape of the human embryo, but our molecular knowledge is almost non-existent, right? So, almost everything we know about it sort of has to come from, you know, comparing what we see in these kinds of things to molecular details from other systems. So that those might be the mouse, but morphologically, it's actually a lot more similar to the chicken, so those might be the chicken as well. Okay, so I'm going to sort of tell you how this gastrulation is thought to work, and it's under the control of a number of signaling pathways, but one of the most important is this nodal pathway. Nodal is a member of the TGF-beta pathway, of which, you know, BMP is a member, so if you're used to DPP in fly, this is a family member with DPP. So nodal is expressed initially, so I don't know if it's sort of obvious, the mapping between this and what I was talking about before, but this is this sort of cup-shaped thing. The site of gastrulation is going to be on one side of this. This is the placental trophoxyderm tissue on top, and this is the extraembryonic tissue that wraps around. And so, in addition, so the site of the gastrulation, which is going to be here, is posterior. The other side is anterior. And then there's also, before that anterior-posterior axis is defined, the simplest axis to define is actually whether you're close to the placenta or far from the placenta, right? So close to the placenta is called proximal. close to these blue cells and far from the placenta is called distal. And when you have these cells in the inner cell mass, these cells all express this TGF-beta family member, which is thought to be a morphogen known as nodal. And this somehow specifically at the bottom tip of the embryo induces a population of cells, which is called the distal visceral endoderm, or DVE, right? And that's because the primitive endoderm is the visceral endoderm, and that's the same thing, and this is just the most distal part of that. And this region is very important because nodal induces its own feedback inhibitor. So these are just feedback inhibitors of nodal. So somehow nodal induces these things, and they start inhibiting nodal at the distal tip of the embryo. And this is one of the sort of earliest events that define this proximal distal axis and start to set up gastrulation. Okay, so after nodal has made this tissue from here, it's actually going to go on and actually make the AP axis through a migration process. So this is a study where they actually did some live cell imaging of this process. And so they have a reporter that labels these cells at the distal tip in green. And you can see that over the course of about 3 hours at a particular stage in development, you see these green cells move, or at least they claim they're moving, towards this side of the embryo. And so the distal visceral endoderm becomes what people call the anterior visceral endoderm. And that's actually what defines the anterior side of the embryo, basically. And so if this process fails for some reason, AP patterning will also fail. So you nodal induces somehow its inhibitors at the tip. That makes these cells. For some reason, these cells migrate, and there's thought to be sort of gradients that maybe have to do with the Wnt pathway that guide this migration. And then, so now I have these nodal inhibitors on this side of the embryo instead of on the distal side. And the thinking is that these nodal inhibitors on this side of the embryo then inhibit nodal to make a gradient that goes from anterior where it's low to posterior where it's high, right? So that's sort of shown schematically here. Should have put the reference, but this is from a paper where they knock down these inhibitors and show that if you knock down these inhibitors, you get nodal signaling in a lot of places that you shouldn't. Right? So you have these inhibitors, they're expressed at this distal tip, they start to move, and then this nodal, which was initially expressed sort of from anterior to posterior, or at least active from anterior to posterior, becomes restricted to this side of the embryo. So now I've initially specified a proximal distal axis, and then I've moved the cells, and that has turned this proximal distal axis into an anterior-posterior axis. Yes?
So this movement is supposed to be just by the gradient of Wnt, or is there any other signaling that the cells move to the...
That's a good question.
What is known?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I think there's... you might be going beyond my... There's a number of mutants that fail to do this. And they might have to be specific ablations. So I think one of them is the DKK Wnt inhibitor that has to specify the anterior cells. So there's some speculation that Wnt is higher posterior than anterior that causes these cells to migrate. But
then the direction of the migration, if everything is symmetrical before, then it would always be random?
Yeah, I think that's not right. That's not well on, right? There's some sort of symmetry breaking event, but I think it's...
Wnt precede the...
I don't know, right, so I don't know any evidence for that, right? So I think these are all very good questions that people, and sort of what I'm trying to get at, that people tell these kinds of stories, and a lot of them are based on knockout phenotypes, but we really don't have any great evidence for how this works. And actually, so the data from this paper is sort of this quality, and people even argue about, you know, how much this migration is really important, or maybe there are signals emanating from this DVE that somehow induce this AVE here, and they're actually a different population of cells which express similar genes, right? So it's hard, unless you have really good cell tracking, to distinguish between these cells moving and sort of a wave of gene expression that, you know, these cells first express the gene and then sort of start to shut it off. And so I think people don't even really know whether these cells have to migrate or not. More questions.
So it may not be a migration.
The cells are moving, right? So, I mean, if you watch these GFP cells, they move. But I think it's not correct to say that there's just some block of tissue that moves in mass. right? They mingle with the cells above them. They induce more cells to express these genes from the reporter. And so the contributions of the migration versus induction by these cells to the making of this APE tissue, I think, is not very clear.
So just circle one more time with what we know and what we don't know. The initial, this, the nodal expression and the nodal movement can be a marker and marker for the symmetry break, a marker for the change for the establishment of a future anterior axis. The thing that's the actual molecular cellular event that is taking this uniform role and marking this side is north or this side is could be wind signaling, but no one's been able to show that. It could be something.
Yeah, I think that's.
We don't know what that event is yet.
I think that's right, and I think it's clear that these inhibitors precede the nodal as a marker, right? So these inhibitors are first expressed distally at a stage where sort of nodal signaling is more uniform here, and then you need these inhibitors to somehow end up over here, whether it's by cell movement or you know induction of these cells to restrict the nodal. But what you know, so that right, yeah, okay, so right, so I think what you're identifying, right, is that there's a big gap between this. And even this is not that clear to me, because what is the mechanism by which nodal, which is expressed all around here, induces this thing only at the distal tip? I think that's not understood either.
And to what extent do we know that this is autonomous to the embryonic tissue as opposed to driven by the extra-embryonic tissue on top?
The yellowish movement is actually in the extraembryonic tissue.
No way.
So these cells are, right, they're cells of the distal visceral endoderm, and they move.
I meant the part that is on top, the blue structure, which is also extraembryonic.
Okay.
Could it be that it's pattern and drives the movement of the...
Could the blue cells on top do what?
Well, we've been looking at the movement of what I thought was a...
There are these green cells that become red and move. Yes.
I want to know whether that movement is driven by some pattern and some symmetry breaking in that structure, as opposed to driven by the blue tissue which is on top on your image.
I don't think that's known. There is some sort of interplay between these two extraembryonic tissues, right? So if I remove this blue tissue, the signals from the bottom can sort of take over the epiblast. So these things are, the balance between signals from here and here is necessary to make the epiblast pattern properly. If I remove one, the other one sort of takes over. But specifically for this migration, I think because once you start hacking these things apart, I don't think the cells are going to migrate anymore. You'll disrupt the tissue integrity and stuff like that. So I don't think the role of... Is it possible that some asymmetry is sort of up here that's sending signals down here? I think it's possible. I don't think there's any evidence to exclude that. Okay. This is good. Don't really understand. We know this thing is made. We don't really understand why it's made here and not all around. We know it moves, or at least induces this wave of gene expression or some combination. And we don't really understand what the earliest cues for that are. The only sort of interesting very recent result, I think, is that this is independent of the embryo being in the uterus of the mother, right? So a role for the uterus itself in the symmetry breaking, I think, has now been excluded. And that was only published a year or so ago. But beyond that, I don't think that much is known. This step is sort of a little clearer, right? You can imagine that once you have these inhibitors on this side, you restrict the nodal to this side.
So the blue part at the bottom, so does it mean there's only...
cytosol down there, or what?
No, sorry. This is not so. You're talking about in these pictures?
Yeah.
No. This is composed of many, many cells, okay. And so. No. Yeah, I think these are just supposed. I stole this from someone's paper, and maybe it's not particularly enlightening, but this is probably a better picture,
okay.
Right? So you have the epiblast is this epithelium. What you really have at this stage for the tissue that we're interested in is you have roughly a two-layered epithelium, right? So there's this epithelial layer of epiblast, and then there's an epithelial layer of visceral endoderm which underlies it. And the molecular interaction between these things, we they all have their own nuclei and stuff like that is important.
Just a suggestion, could the accumulation of the curl and lefty, those inhibitors, just be somehow curvature dependent?
Maybe. There was a recent suggestion that I think people don't believe, but people did some experiments where they took embryos out and they cultured them under different constriction. And the claim was that you actually had to have the embryo constricted, and that actually they were claiming that there's a breach of the basement membrane between the cell layers here, and that would allow the flow of first nodal through to induce these things, specifically here. I think most people in the field don't believe that, but whether this geometry is important for inducing these things, I think it's certainly possible. And you could even imagine, right? I mean, I don't think anyone's, okay, I'll show you in a minute, sort of, right? So I'm showing you all these cartoons. I'll show you very briefly in a minute the sort of state of the quality of the data that these cartoons come from, right? And I think you'll see that, right, anything is possible. We really don't know. It's sort of sad to say, but we sort of have some fuzzy idea of where these things are expressed, right? Because you can do these in situ hybridizations. But we don't know where the proteins for them, these are all secreted molecules that could, in theory, diffuse. We have no measurements of where the proteins for them end up, because the antibody staining and imaging is just not good enough to see them in most cases. And then we don't really know where the activity of those things are. And that's an easier question that really should be tackled, but hasn't been satisfactory.
So there are so you even don't know if there are any curl and lefties on the site, but are just in lower concentrations?
Yeah, so we don't know. We know, right, that if, we know that if I do in situ hybridization, the cells that have the RNA are down here and then over here. Where the protein is, we don't know, right? We tell a story about where the protein is active because if I knock these things down, I see a phenotype in specific places. So we say, okay, there. But whether it makes a gradient over that area or we just don't know. Yeah.
Maybe it's important to precise, that everything post-implantation is for formalins. Embryo is, I mean, there is not much known, I think, because it's extremely difficult mm-hmm. to maintain, to
yes.
study them in
yes.
vitro.
Yes, absolutely. The reviewer of one of our papers actually just called our attention. There are some amazing papers from the 70s where people did ex utero culture of mammalian embryos all the way through to like somites and beating hearts and stuff. It sort of blew me away. There's a science paper from the late 70s or early 80s that has something like 30 citations. So how people did this, and then it just got totally lost. I think it may be that you can't strip away a lot of these sort of extra embryonic tissues during that process. You can't really see what's happening in the embryo that well, and it certainly predated the time where you could do fluorescence imaging or any serious microscopy with them. People don't have access to these embryos at all, but it may be possible. And then there's been, not nearly as sort of impressive in how far they go in development, but there's been a recent couple of papers, first for mouse and very recently for human, where they've shown embryos go through the implantation process in a culture dish. So the Zernica Goats lab in Cambridge is sort of leading that. Okay, so then what happens next in my story is that, I've positioned nodal towards the this is sort of on the anterior distal side, the inhibitors, and so I've positioned nodal to the proximal posterior side, and there's a feedback loop involving three pathways now, and between two different tissues. And all of these things turn out to be very important for gastrulation. So if I kill any of these three, I don't gastrulate properly. So there's some complicated molecular details here, but roughly, nodal induces BMP in this trophectodermal tissue. The BMP comes back to the embryonic tissue and induces WNT3, and WNT3 induces nodal. And so these are, to be clear, everything labeled in this diagram is an extracellular signaling molecule that's triggering a cascade of intracellular signaling, and the next thing at the other end of the arrow is a target of that intracellular cascade, right? So I make nodal over here, the nodal diffuses, it binds to cells over here, there's a signaling response that leads to the transcription of BMP4 ligand, which is then turned into protein and secreted, and the process continues with the same thing happening to WNT. Yeah.
The repressors of nodal.
They're all the way down here.
Where?
So, okay, so I don't know why they chose to split this figure, but you can actually, if you imagine this territory is, you know, we noticed before that there's actually only one cell here not represented in this blowout, so I don't know why they just cut out this one cell here. But so you can imagine just pasting this on top of each other, right? So the inhibitors start here and move over here, right? And so they're on the far end of the embryo, which induces nodal to become, which was initially sort of broadly expressed throughout here, to become restricted here, initiates this feedback loop, which is important for sustaining gastrulation. So there's some evidence that if I just do like sort of the kick on of this feedback loop but can't sustain it because I'm missing some component of it, that I'll sort of initiate gastrulation and then it'll peter out. I need some sort of self-sustaining feedback loop up here. Okay, so what's the problem with all this? So I think a lot of what we're getting at, right, the state of the data, so I've told you a story, but the state of the data from which we've constructed this story is, you know, sort of to a quantitative person, really poor, right? So, I mean, here's sort of a quote-unquote good stain for nodal because they knock LAC-Z into the nodal locus, and so they can do LAC-Z staining for where nodal is. So this is at the stages where nodal should be restricted to the proximal posterior side. And, you know, yeah, sure, there's more staining up here than down here, but you could never put a number on this picture, right? And so most of us wouldn't feel comfortable really making a model with this kind of data. And that means that most of our evidence for what's happening is very indirect from genetic knockouts, right? So here's a summary picture from a sort of thorough paper where they took, okay, so nodal, not to get into too many molecular details, but nodal has two signal transducers, SMAD2 and SMAD3. So they cross two heterozygotes of SMAD2 and SMAD3, so you can generate all possible combinations of these alleles for SMAD2 and SMAD3. And so the most signaling is in, right, the thing that's homozygous for both of them, and the least signaling is when you have the homozygous knockout, and then you see this sort of recession of cell fates, right? So the thinking is that these cell fates require the highest levels of nodal signaling. You know, I remove one copy of one of my transducers and I lose a little bit. I remove another copy and I lose a little bit. And so there's this sort of graded precession of phenotype, right? But there's a huge gap here between the perturbation and the measurement, right? I change the DNA, I remove a copy of the signal transducer, lots of stuff happens in the embryo, and I'm measuring the loss of these cell fates, right? And I have no knowledge of, you know, where the nodal was expressed, where these signals were transduced, right, and how that led to this sort of abrogation of different fates. Okay, so I think that highlights some issues, some of which we've sort of already talked about, right? So do we really understand how this nodal morphogen works, right? So are the expression patterns really consistent with its function? Well, right, as we said, the earliest activity is to induce its inhibitors at the distal tip, but nobody has ever seen a gradient of nodal which is high at the distal tip. If anything, the gradient of nodal goes the opposite way. So how, if it's, you know, a proximal to distal gradient, how is it inducing something specifically at the distal tip? And then the other sort of puzzle of on the early stages is that nodal is expressed everywhere in the epiblast throughout gastrulation, but in theory nodal is supposed to trigger gastrulation. So why does nodal only trigger gastrulation slightly later at this one site on the proximal posterior side? Right? As we said, nodal RNA, right? Does it imply that there's nodal protein? Does that imply that there's activity? Right? The fact that you have these extracellular inhibitors that bind to nodal and prevent it from signaling clearly means that nodal protein doesn't always imply nodal activity. But we have no data really on any of these stages. There's basically a single paper where people tried to measure the activity of the signal transducers, and the data is sufficiently poor that every mouse person I talk to doesn't believe it. But since we know we have these changing expression patterns, we know that whatever sort of gradient, if you want to call it that, of nodal must be dynamic. And since we don't know anything about the protein or the activity, we don't know anything about how cells interpret this changing dynamic signal to actually make patterns of cell fate. As someone alluded to earlier in the questions, the not is a little faint, but this is supposed to say that a human is not equal to a mouse, right? So you have these sort of gross differences in geometry and other things, right? And for molecular aspects, we really don't know, right? We just study these model organisms and assume the human is the same, but we don't know if it is or not. Yeah.
Is there a temporal delay between event which is happening at the distal tip to the proximal end?
Is there a
temporal delay? Does one precede the other?
Yes. So it's at the distal tip first. And then, right, so this sort of sequence of events that I told you happens over the course of a day or so during mouse development, right?
But
so
there is no nodal laxity staining at...
At no stage is there nodal laxity that's higher distally than proximally, right? So you see this broad... if I go back to this kind of lousy picture, right, roughly what you see is this... Well, first, I think this is not clear, but I think it's supposed to show sort of weaker, broader expression of nodal before you induce it. You induce these inhibitors, and it pushes it more proximal, and then the inhibitors move, and it also postures it more posterior. Right? So it goes from expressed everywhere to expressed here, but that doesn't explain how it has specific activity down here. Right? Okay, more in my next talk want to sort of lay out the case that we can make some progress on these issues with culture cells. Superficially plug this idea. I think the first knock on culture cells is that, okay, you know, you have cells in a dish, they don't look anything like an embryo, they don't make patterns. Right, that's not necessarily true. So we now have ways, and they're not very complicated ways. They just involve controlling a little bit how the cells grow, and you sort of harness the ability of these cells to make patterns. So this is sort of a typical experiment in my lab where you have these patterns where the green is the extraembryonic surrounding it, and then you have mesodermal and ectodermal cell phase, and you would actually have some endoderm squeezed in here, but it's not stained for at the same time. It's very difficult to study dynamics in the mouse. I won't say it's impossible to do it in model organisms because, of course, we just saw some really nice fish movies, but we can study dynamics of these. Zoom in on a few of these cells. This is a signal transducer that translates between the nucleus and the cytoplasm, and so we can get really nice data on what all these cells are doing and whether these things are moving into the nucleus or not. Right? So I think, to me, this is at least a piece of the data that's really missing from the mouse, right? Dynamic data on what these signaling pathways are doing at different times. But you could argue, I saw some really nice fish movies. You know, maybe I don't care if it's a fish or a mouse. Why don't you just do this with a fish? So here are some things that are hard to do with a fish, right? I've never seen a square fish, but I can make a square stem cell colony and ask how the pattern is perturbed, and you start to see some interesting things, right? So in the circle, right, you can show quantitatively that everything has to do with distance from the boundary. When I start to make corners, that's not true anymore, right? You can imagine the the shape of this blue territory is not just a square displaced from the boundary, right? I see these corner effects where these cell fates move in specifically at the corners. You can play with geometry and modulate its effects. Yeah.
How big need these structures need to be so that you get these pattern formations? Or how big of a circle do you need to have?
Okay, yeah, so I'll talk about this in detail on next week, but roughly you can make patterns on the scale of, say, a few hundred microns to, say, 200-300 microns to a millimeter, and you get sort of a full spectrum of cell fates above 500 microns or so. And what we see is that as you make the thing smaller, you still make patterns, but you start to squeeze out the center fates, right? So there's at least some sense in which the fates are defined from the boundary and proceed inward, so that if I have less territory, I still have the boundary fates, but I don't have the center fate. But that's obviously, there's other aspects of the geometry that it's sensitive to, right, which is sort of shown in these kinds of pictures.
I have a question. So are these cells just, is there a uniform growth factor everywhere, or, and they just, they adopt different fates by their neighbors, or?
Yes, basically that, so you're talking about in these stem cells.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so the protocol for differentiating these things basically is you know, you make these patterned substrates where you constrict their movement, but then you just grow them as stem cells normally would, and then you dump differentiating ligand, in this case, you know, BMP, the DPP homolog, into culture, everywhere in the culture media. So in theory, it's accessible to all of the cells. And the, what we've shown is that there's a sort of multi-layered regulation that involves making these patterns. So the first part is that even though the BMP is everywhere, the cells don't respond equally well everywhere. And we've shown that's because some cells have a pre-pattern of expressing BMP inhibitors. So, and there may actually be other, so Ali's lab, who's still working on this, is working on a story where it actually may have to do with the apical basal polarity of these cells and whether the receptors themselves are accessible in the center of this colony. But they respond differentially to the BMP, even though it's everywhere, and then that causes these downstream targets in this feedback loop to be specifically expressed, we think. And so some of these cell fates here they require endogenous signaling between the cells. So if I add my initial BMP differentiating ligand, but I inhibit the nodal pathway, for example, I don't get any of these green territories anymore. Right?
And the patterns you get depend on the amount. You have like a little square or something, you stick all these cells on it, they're all uniform, but then the geometry of how they're stuck on impacts the signaling and interactions in a way to produce the
pattern. That's what we believe. We don't totally understand how that worked, right? So we started doing these experiments to sort of test the null hypothesis that it's a one variable thing, and that one variable is your distance from the boundary, right? This proves that that's not true, right? But
to what extent do you know that it's pattern in a system? Well, to what extent do you know that the cells locally or at larger scale will solve depending on some transient fate that they may acquire, and then that the pattern emerges from cell movement as opposed to?
Yes, yeah, so that's something we're quite interested
I mean?
In. Yeah, and actually, the expression patterns of these things, a lot of them are dynamic, right? So these are sort of the final patterns that you're looking at. But a lot of, say, like these green cells, we haven't done this on all shapes, but at least in circles, we see them initially at the border, and then we see them further in. Now, whether that's because there's a wave, again, it's sort of the same question, right? Is there a wave of gene expression that the cells at the border shut it off, and, you know, they sort of transiently making decisions and then have decided not to be that fate, or those cells move? We don't know. So we're actually, I mean, a nice thing about this system is, right, we can do cell tracking experiments.
So there could be at some point a stationary pattern whereby cells could nonetheless go from one domain to another and switch fate,
uh-huh.
Or is it that they're locked in, and that they're being locked in a fate would cause some kind of aggregation phenomenon that they would go into a domain or another?
Yes. So we don't.
You don't know.
We're not 100. I think the truth is probably somewhere in between, but we don't know. So we have. these are all antibody stains. We have CRISPR reporters now for a number of these phages, so we're watching at how these things turn on and how they move within these colonies. It's still quite preliminary, but we know that there's not very drastic cell movements, right? Nothing's like crossing the colony or something like that. But you may have some sorting at the boundaries of these phages. People have published like nice stories about sonic hedgehog and fish, where you say make a sloppy pattern and then there's some cell sorting to make a cleaner pattern. I think it's certainly possible that something like that is at play here.
Does the number of cells which you seed matter?
Yes, okay. Very much. So the simplest way in which it matters is that. Is that if your colony is not quite confluent, right, you don't get a reproducible pattern, right? Because there's sort of only one way to be confluent, but there's lots of ways to be non-confluent, right? And each of those could have their own pattern. But even once you get confluence, these cells don't have a very fixed size. As they grow, they'll still make an epithelium and they'll pack in. And the pattern scales down correspondingly, although it doesn't seem to be a rigid scaling, right? The pattern gets shorter as the cells get denser, but we haven't been able to see that it's a strict. It's not that just that there's a fixed number of cells from the boundary, right? So the number of cells involved in the pattern also shrinks with cell density.
Also, I might have missed this. What are the colors stained?
So the blue is a gene called SOX2, which marks both. Pluripotent stem cells and ectoderm. I'm not showing you the data here, but these cells lack other markers of pluripotent stem cells, so they're ectoderm. The green here is brachyury, which marks mesoderm, and the red is CDX2, which at least in the absence of brachyury will typically mark this trophoblast extraembryonic tissue, although if you're paying really close attention, you might object that these cells, these epiblast cells, should have been lineage restricted from giving rise to trophoblast. So why we can start with a population of epiblast cells and sort of take them two steps back and allow them to differentiate to trophoblast is very unclear. And I think, in my view, the molecular data that this happens is now very, very good. But there are some, you know, hardcore in vivo developmental biologists that just don't believe it. They say, you know, this never happens in vivo. It's some weird thing. I don't believe these are real trophoblast cells. So the other thing that you can do in culture is that, right, there's all kinds of microfluidic devices. It's much easier to get cells into these microfluidic devices and to ensure uniform presentation of ligands to these things within cells. So these are just some food dyes moving around in culture chambers, but we can much more readily perturb the dynamics of signaling and things like this, and then, you know, use experiments like these patterned experiments or more appropriately, like these kind of experiments to tell what's really the relationship between the signals the cells see and the signals they transduce, and then further, what's the relationship by following the same cells, what's the relationship between these signals and the fates that you'll ultimately get.
Why is the pattern reversed from green on red? So if you have a square, then you have a different pattern from the circle.
I apologize. This is a error. Well, these were generated by two different people in my lab, who I guess have their own color. So green and red are actually switched. Sorry. I was pulling slides from different people's experiments at the last minute. So yeah, you have a good eye. But what we've seen, the rough pattern of cell phase from in to out is always the same. Okay, so that was sort of, and those are things I'll talk about much more next week, but that was sort of my brief pitch for why we want to study stem cells. And now I guess I'd like to spend most of the remainder of my time telling you what are these stem cells. So stem cells come from the early mammalian embryo, so you have this progression of cells and you make this first decision. And people have realized that if I take the cells out of this inner cell mass and throw them into a culture dish, and give them the right cytokines, they'll grow in these culture dishes essentially indefinitely, right? And they possess the two properties of pluripotent stem cells, which is that they're indefinitely self-renewing, and they can also give rise to all the tissue types in the body. So people have actually grown entire mice out of these stem cells. Of course, we believe we can grow entire humans out of these stem cells, but we're not going to do it. An interesting fact about these stem cells that I think still no one really properly understands is that when I do the same procedure of derivation in mouse and human, I don't end up with the same looking cells. And what people have come to realize is that these mouse stem cells look a lot like the cells of the ICM at these earlier stages, and these human stem cells look a lot like the cells of the epiblast at this later stage. And people have gotten better actually at sort of interconverting between the states, so I can derive mouse cells and make them look human-like, or human cells and make them look mouse-like. But I think there's still a clear sort of fact that the mouse cells are more stable in one state and the human cells are more stable in the opposite state, and I don't think anyone really understands why.
Could you mix them up actually to see?
What do you want to mix?
Well, if cell shape is a factor, maybe you would see whether patterns would, you know, if they were able to respond to the same signal but nonetheless have a different shape, then maybe.
The shape of the mouse versus the human cells, or?
Well, I thought you were asking the question of the contribution of cell shape to particular response.
Oh, okay. You're talking about one slide back.
Or no? I don't want to stall you. Maybe we can discuss later on.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So I'll talk a lot about that data next week. So. Okay. So, but here the sort of puzzlement is that, you know, the mouse and human behave quite differently. And even though we found ways to make them behave the same, we don't understand why their sort of inclination is to behave differently. So how do people tell if these cells are really stem cells? So there's a number of assays that people use to do this. The simplest is you basically take the cells, throw them in a lump, let that lump differentiate, and look at what you've got in your lump, right? And people can, inside the same lump in some disorganized fashion, right, we can see things that are specifically ectoderm, mesoderm, and endoderm, and so having the three germ layers, we assume they're pluripotent. A similar, although slightly crueler, experiment is to inject these stem cells into mice. They'll give the mouse a tumor known as a teratoma, and then I can do the histology on this tumor to similarly show that these cells are pluripotent and that within the same tumor I get, you know, derivatives of all these germ layers. And then the sort of most, so we can do these assays with both mouse and human cells. This is a sort of mouse-only assay, but people have realized that there are ways to take a mouse embryo and I guess basically shock it to make it tetraploid somehow. And then if I inject mouse stem cells, which are diploid, into that embryo, then the tetraploid cells are still capable of giving rise to the extraembryonic tissues, but not to the embryo proper. And so by doing this, my entire embryo proper has to come from the stem cells I've injected. Right, so this is a very rigorous proof of pluripotency, because I can take stem cells, and I can grow an entire mouse out of these stem cells in this way. Okay, so what do these cells look like? And I guess in what follows, I've sort of taken a historical perspective to try to give some sense of when people found these various things and sort of when it was done. So right, this is a little more than 30 years ago. People realized that we could grow these mouse cells and that they look like the inner cell mass of mouse. So there's kind of these clumped up cells that are not really epithelial. And they mimic the organization of the inner cell mass in vivo. So it was quite a bit later when people realized that they could do the same thing in human cells, and you can see these also look quite a bit different, right? So they're these flat spread epithelial colonies that mimic the organization of the epiblast, which is itself a flat epithelium. And so this came almost 20 years later. Okay, now people realize that if you do the right things, right, you can get mouse cells that look like the human cells, so that are like epiblasts, and they express the markers of epiblasts and all that. So I can get mouse cells at the stage of human cells, probably shouldn't go through this whole table, right? But the morphology is quite different, right? These are rounded and these are flat and epithelial, The signaling requirements are quite different, as I'll get into in a minute. But they all have all the hallmarks of pluripotency. But you also see these signatures of the mouse cells being earlier, right? So one of the primary ones is X inactivation, right? So female cells, female cells have two X chromosomes. To develop properly, they have to inactivate one. So mouse stem cells, if you look at them, they have two active X chromosomes. These human stem cells, or these human-like mouse stem cells, will have inactivated an X chromosome. So this is more evidence for this transitioning down this developmental pathway. Yes?
What do you mean by human-like stem cell from the mouse?
Okay, so what I mean is that, right, when I, as I said, when if I take cells from an equivalently staged mouse or human embryo, and the stage of that cell is when the cells are intercell mass. So if it quickly, right, so I'm taking cells from this stage, right? So I have these intercell mass cells. I take them out, and I try to culture them. If I do that in the simplest way for mouse, I'll end up with intercell mass cells, just like I would expect. If I do that for human, I actually end up with cells that look like epiblast, right? So like a day later in mouse development. And people don't really understand why this is. But people have figured out, okay, what if I, you know, can I define a protocol where, you know, I wait a day or so, then I take these cells out of a mouse, can I actually get a line of these epiblast stem cells, which are sort of human stem cell-like? If that makes sense. So the mouse stem cells are this stage, the human stem cells are this stage. I can get mouse stem cells at this stage.
Can't you take them earlier, at the 16 cell stage? At the end of 16 cell stage?
Good question. I haven't seen anyone who can grow these cells in culture. I don't know why. You know, in theory, they're prolific. They should grow, but I don't think it's ever been done. And there must be some technical hurdles there. Okay, so these are mouse stem cells that look more human. So these pictures are not great from this paper, but basically, you know, if you take them earlier, they're sort of more rounded up, and if you take them later, they have this flattened epithelial morphology. So you can all, this took a lot longer, but people figured out how to grow human stem cells that look like the ICM or like your typical mouse stem cells. And this is the sort of horrible recipe they figured out to do it, which gives you some idea of why it was not easy, right? So there's this whole combination of ligands and small molecule inhibitors. You're activating or inhibiting like 10 different pathways to get them to do this. So human cells will do it, but they really don't want to, right? You take mouse cells out of an embryo, I grow them in some serum and one growth factor called LIF, and they'll grow in this state. These human stem cells, I really have to hammer them, right?
Essentially, you seem to inhibit rubbing
cases
or contractility, right?
Yes. Okay. So for whatever reason, I think these are called optimizing components because another sort of functional difference between mouse and human stem cells is that mouse stem cells will happily propagate as single cells. You can trypsinize them to single cells and replate them, and they do fine. Human stem cells don't like that at all. And so what people discovered was that this ROCK inhibitor, and probably this functions in a single way, can somehow sort of trick the cell into thinking that it still has neighbors, and then it survives the single cell pathogen. And so I think there's some, during this transition from these cells that require a ROCK inhibitor for their single cell passage to the cells that don't, there's some, it works more efficiently if you keep them happy throughout. Basically you're inhibiting all kinds of MAP kinase pathways here. You're stimulating Wnt through GSK3 beta. You're stimulating TGF beta and FGF and LIF pathways. So this is almost like some amalgamation of everything that maintains both mouse and human stem cells. I want to mention briefly, why, even though it's not sort of directly relevant for what I'm going to talk about, but I think it's important to know why stem cells have been so important for studying mammalian development. And the answer is that shortly, so this is only 4 years after you know, the stem cells were first derived, people realized, hey, if I can make a mouse from these cells, then I can take these cells, I can modify their genome, and I can make a mouse with a modified genome, right? So that's a huge advance. So this is one of the first papers that did that. They had cells with a mutant gene called HPRT. They were able to supply the cell with the DNA, so it was missing some exons. They were able to supply the DNA for those exons with some homologous sequence. It goes in and it corrects the gene. So this was the first paper to show, or maybe, I shouldn't say first, but it was certainly one of the first to show that you could take plasmid DNA, insert it into the genome, and then grow a mouse with that genome. And then people realized, okay, well, I can also knock out genes if I want, right? So a couple of years later, they said, okay, well, what if I take something in the same gene, I make some mutation that will be inactivating. And I, you know, at the time it turned out that, okay, it's really hard to find, right? If this has, say, a 1% efficiency or something, how do I find the 1% of cells that I made my mutation in, right? Do I really want to grow 100 different clones of cells and screen them all by some, you know, terrible southern blotting procedure to find this? Well, we'd rather not. So they said, well, okay, what if at the same time I inactivate it, I throw in a neomycin resistance gene? So now I kill everything that's not inactivated with neomycin. And so I won't read this, but this paper in the discussion basically, you know, laid out the future of the next 20 years of mouse research by saying, you know, now that you can use ES cells, you can make this targeted mutation, and you can grow cells, and also you can make heterozygotes, so things that are embryonic lethal, you have the heterozygotes, you make them, and so this really established the mouse as a genetic system. Okay, so these papers were all in stem cells, right? It hadn't been realized in the mouse, but it was only another year or so before people were actually growing mice with these mutations. And, you know, within 20 years or so, a lot of the people involved in this had been awarded the Nobel Prize for doing this work. So, so stem cells really sort of, the ability to grow them really revolutionized the way that we can study development in these mammalian systems. Okay, this is sort of a schematic about how this thing works, which I think I'm going to skip in the interest of time, and I'll tell you a little bit more about how we grow these stem cells and what is required. There's a hierarchy of regulation, right, from the morphogen signals that maintain the cell fate through the signaling of factors to the nucleus of the cell where these transcriptional targets, and so what are these sort of necessary signals for propagating stem cells? And one of the sort of earliest observations people had about stem-like cells, these were actually cells from the animal cap of the Xenopus embryo, was that, so these cells are cells that are going to form the ectoderm of the embryo, and people realized if I just take them and I take them apart, they'll become neurons, right? But if I take them out of the embryo and culture them lumped together, they become epithelial tissue, so the ventral ectoderm versus the dorsal ectoderm. So for a long time, people didn't understand why that was, and they thought, you know, there must be some sort of signals passed between the cells that when they're lumped together, they get removed when they get taken apart. And over time, people realized that those signals were members of this TGF-beta family, both the TGF-beta ligands and the BMP ligands. And so, you know, a while ago in frog, people showed you can inhibit these pathways and get neural. And then more recently with human cells, right, if I take these human cells growing in the pluripotent fate and I inhibit these two pathways, I get a very efficient conversion to neural cells. And so this underlies the idea that sort of the default fate of a cell in a lot of organisms is actually to become a neuron. So if I remove all signals from a pluripotent cell, it wants to become a neuron, and this seems to be true, you know, from frogs all the way up to humans, right? And so here's an example where I've dumped in inhibitors for these two pathways, right? OCH4 is a stem cell marker, and PAX6 is a neuronal marker, and over the course of a week, I get sort of uniform loss of this OCH4, and then complete gain of this PAX6, so I get this huge culture of neurons just by inhibiting two signaling pathways. So there are some signals that are keeping cells in this state, and so people identified these quite some time ago now, right? So Austin Smith, who's still a big name in the stem cell field, was one of the first people to clone a factor that's required for stem cells, right? And he showed that this LIF, right, which stands for leukemia inhibitory factor, is very important for growing these mouse cells in this ICM stage, right? And that the time I think was very interesting because, right, I mean, it's called leukemia inhibitory factor because it plays this role in leukemia, basically, and he showed that this is really important for these earliest stages of development. But they still had to grow these cells in serum, right? So there's some sort of mess of stuff you're throwing in, and then you're throwing in the LIF, and the cells are happy. But what's the other signal that cells need? And so there's another paper from Austin Smith's lab quite a bit later. He showed that the other signal could be this BMP TGF-beta ligand, right? So now he can grow cells in these defined conditions by stimulating these two pathways. So I guess I won't get into the data too much here, right? But a bunch of different conditions, if you add the wrong thing, so if you add only BMP, you get conversion to these sort of extra-embryonic looking cells. If you add none of these signals, you get these neurons, right? This is a neuronal marker, and you can see them. And if you add both of these signals, you get these nice stem cell colonies that express this gene called OCT4, which is a marker of stem cells. Okay, and now people have sort of realized that what can I do the opposite program, right? Must I activate these signaling pathways? Or what if I just take cells and I inhibit differentiating signals? Is that enough to keep cells in a stem cell state? And so people started inhibiting signals that differentiate mouse embryonic stem cells and mouse embryonic stem cells. And these are basically inhibition of signals from the FGF pathway and then inhibition of this thing called GSK3-beta. And this turned out to be actually an extremely robust combination of growing stem cells. So you can grow this combination of three inhibitors. People have now basically gotten rid of the FGF inhibitor since it's the same pathway and grow them in these conditions that people call 2I for two inhibitors. And people say, okay, you know, he got it into nature by calling this the ground state of stem cells because you're inhibiting everything or something. I don't know. But how true this is not clear because what's this GSK3-beta doing? Is it really suppressing a differentiation pathway? Right. It turns out that, of course, GSK3-beta is a very important component of the Wnt pathway, and it plays an inhibitory role in the Wnt pathway. So sometime later, right, people showed that actually stem cells require Wnt to prevent differentiation. So even in these cases, what they're calling the ground state, that you're inhibiting a bunch of pathways, probably really what you're doing is you're inhibiting an inhibitor of Wnt, which turns out to maintain these cells. But I think this sort of highlights an area where some caution is required because of much, much more recently, so only a couple years ago, people said, okay, well, if Wnt signaling is really important for maintaining stem cells, then Wnt signaling should be really important in the early embryo. So Janet Rasson's lab did this experiment where they knocked out this gene, which is required for the processing of all Wnt ligands. So in theory, you knock out this gene, you have no more Wnt signaling in the embryo, and the embryos are totally fine. So I think people still don't understand this discrepancy, but it certainly looks like this requirement for Wnt proteins is a culture artifact. And I think that as people, doing developmental research for stem cells, this is something we keep in mind. There are things that can be true in stem cell culture, which just may not be true in an embryo for whatever reason. And maybe the reasons underlining that are interesting, but we certainly have to be careful about which of the claims that we see extrapolate to the embryo, especially when the molecular mechanisms are sort of novel. Okay, and as you might expect from the fact that they're in a different state, the signals that maintain human stem cells are totally different, right? So nodal is one of the signals, and FGF is the other. And this nodal signal is actually consistent with the story I told you before, right? So nodal is expressed throughout the epiblast of the mouse embryo. These are epiblast-like stem cells, and what people have found in stem cells is that if you don't have this nodal signaling, you don't have stem cells anymore. They basically all differentiate. So now a little bit about the transcriptional networks that maintain these stem cells, also to sort of highlight how research goes back and forth from stem cell culture to embryo culture. So this was one of the first genes found to be super important for stem cells, which is called OCT4, without which you can't have any stem cells. And the way it was discovered is kind of instructive. So they actually had a mouse heterozygote for OCT4. They started crossing it, and they found that you don't get Mendelian inheritance. You actually can't find any of the knockouts at all. right? So any of the homozygous deletions, right, they didn't exist at later stages. So they had to sort of laboriously go back to earlier and earlier stages. As they got to these sort of pre-gastrulation stages, what they found was that there were still no embryos there, but they could identify the sites where an embryo had been, right, in the uterus. And so they said, okay, we got to go even earlier. And when they got really early embryos from E3.5, what they found was you had these embryos, which are not really embryos because they're entirely composed of this extra embryonic trophoblastic tissue, right? So it was in this way that they found that OCH4 is essential for maintaining this ICM state, because if you don't have it, you basically passed, you know, very early development, you don't have an embryo at all. And if you look early enough, you basically just have a lump of this extra embryonic tissue. So this was sort of a laborious process of cloning this gene by looking at this mutant phenotype. Another factor which sort of plays a crucial role in stem cells, and which you may have heard of, is called NANOG. And this was found in almost an exactly opposite way. So actually, it's from the same lab. People, they started asking the question, are there genes that I can throw into stem cells under conditions in which they should differentiate, which they now won't differentiate, right? And so they started throwing in libraries of plasmids into cells, looking for colonies of undifferentiated cells under differentiated conditions, and they found some, and it turned out that one of these encoded this gene called NANOG. And then, right, having discovered this, they went back to the embryo and did these stains and asked, okay, where is NANOG expressed in the embryo? And it turned out it's expressed exactly where you would think it would be based on this experiment, right? It's expressed in the ICM and then in the epiplast, right? So the sort of shift in thinking from sort of doing this in the embryo and doing this in stem cells, right, allowed the same lab to clone two stem cell genes, but I have to think that these experiments were much, much easier to do than the previous experiment. But actually, the previous experiment, right, you really couldn't do it in an unbiased way. They had to sort of stumble on this OCH4 heterozygote that they crossed and it didn't have any progeny, right? But here, right, they did this unbiased screen, they pulled out this gene, and it turns out to be super important for development. So people have put a lot of work into sort of understanding the circuitry of these things, and they found these genes that are all very important, and then they started, you know, looking at what they bind to, and of course they all bind to each other's promoters. So this OCH4 and NANOG and this other gene, SOC2, all bind to each other's promoters and activate themselves, and people think that this has sort of a self-reinforcing network that stabilizes the pluripotent fate. But what I think has been a very interesting development in recent years is that people have started to use stem cells to understand what's the relationship between cells growing in this pluripotent fate and the differentiated fates that come from that pluripotent fate, right? So is it that I just basically have these bunch of genes in this self-reinforcing network, I have to kill the whole thing and then start turning on some differentiation genes, or is there something interesting happening in the transition there? And this is a much easier question to study in stem cells than in the embryo, because I basically stabilize this pluripotent fate. Right? So I can grow cells in these pluripotent fates, differentiate them, and see how they're exiting this state, as opposed to sort of trying to capture the transition between two very transient states in an embryo. Okay, and the sort of summary of what people have found is that all of these genes, besides promoting the pluripotent state, are actually repressing different lineage-specific factors, right? So, and this is kind of a complicated diagram, but if you take these important things, right, so OCH4, it's repressing extraembryonic tissues. So sometimes they're actually activating some of these things, right? NANOG is repressing mesoderm. So all these things serve to see either activate or repress genes. And then when people looked in detail, so this was a nice paper from Sharad Ramanathan's lab at Harvard, right, they looked at the dynamics of these genes as cells differentiate, right? So do you just see, I take these cells, I differentiate them, do you just see everything go down? And it turns out that what you see depends on the differentiated fate that you're getting, right? So if I take these cells that express OCH4 and I differentiate them to neuronal fates, they kill OCH4 relatively rapidly over a period of 20 hours, right? If I take cells, and you can, that's sort of the same data here. But if I take cells and I do a mesendoderm differentiation protocol, OCH4 actually rises during that protocol, right? So there's not a unique mechanism of exiting this pluripotent state. How the state is disassembled is important for how it transitions into the differentiated fate. And they showed that SOX2 does the exact opposite, right? So when I differentiate to ectoderm, SOX2 rises and OCH4 is right, going down. When I differentiate to mesenderm, SOX2 is killed almost immediately, and Notch4 does the opposite. So this sort of view has emerged where you have these things maintaining this fate, but each is inhibiting different fates, and then you destabilize the pluripotent fate by triggering a difference in balance between these things which specify the fate, which pushes you more towards one differentiated fate than the other. I'm not going to say a lot about this, except to say that people have done a lot of work in stem cells and chromatin structure and things like this. And the interesting thing that people have found is that they're often sort of not expressing genes, but poised to express them, right? So they have both repressive and activating marks on the chromatin of a lot of these key genes, and that means that they can sort of remove the repressive mark and just start firing away. So a lot of these genes are, the chromatin of stem cells is very open. You have this, what they call this bivalent chromatin structure, and they're sort of ready to go for this differentiation. And this is about the open chromatin. The last couple minutes, I would sort of be remiss if I didn't mention these experiments, which people talk a lot about now, right? So, I think, you know, it's both very medically important, but really, I think sort of fundamentally upended people's ideas about the plasticity of cells, right? People thought, hey, you take stem cells, you differentiate them, right, that's it, there's no going back. And, you know, Yamanaka did these experiments where he believed that there must be some way to go back, so he was taking, you know, differentiated fibroblast cells, throwing lots of combinations of different factors in them that were associated with pluripotent cells, and asking if he ever got pluripotent colonies out of these experiments. And so, you know, he identified some combination of 24 factors where he was actually getting a lot of pluripotent colonies. He started paring them down systematically and was able to get it down to a recipe of 4 transcription factors that will induce these cells to revert their state to stem cells. And so, right, I think this, for stem cell research of the type that we do, is not very important, right? Because I could use these iPS cells, I could use stem cells, they all behave similarly. But I think it's sort of fundamentally upended how people think about these states. And of course, for the purposes of deriving patient-specific material, right now I can, if you have a disease and you need stem cells, I can take your cells, I can reprogram them, and now your immune system's not going to reject them. So of course, he won the Nobel Prize for this. John Gurdon won the Nobel Prize along with him for research he had done almost more than 50 years earlier, where he basically cloned a frog in a much more low-tech way by taking the nucleus of a differentiated cell. So it would be like taking the nucleus of this cell, taking an oocyte, putting it into the oocyte, and somehow the cytoplasm of the oocyte actually does this reprogramming for you, so converts that nucleus back to a stem cell-like nucleus. It turned out for stem cells, right, actually this, after everything we've learned about molecular biology, it was much easier to do this sort of 4-factor reprogramming. But very, very recently, people have realized that you can actually do the same thing with human cells. So you can take the nucleus from a human cell, you can put it into a human oocyte, and reprogram it. That works too. And this may be important for things like mitochondrial replacement therapy, right? So if someone has a mitochondrial disease, right, their nucleus is fine. So if you could take their nucleus and put it into an oocyte from someone else, in theory, you could replace their mitochondria and they could have a healthy child. Although, you know, there's been some debate about how much carryover there is with the with the nucleus and stuff like that. So a couple words about, I think, things that sort of people have done in stem cells that are sort of almost impossible to do in other systems. So one is thinking about the heterogeneity of these cellular states, right? So we have a thing in the mouse embryo that we call epiblast, but how do we know if that's all the same thing or not, right? So people have now taken epiblasts, you grow epiblasts as stem cells, and you start to look in detail at whether these cells are all the same, do they all express the same stuff, do they all have the same potential, and people have found this, you know, sort of, they're not all the same, that there's sort of discrete substates of them that people transition between them. Of course, the flip side of that is, you know, does any of this really matter for development? Should we care about these? Are they all culture artifacts? I think that's not clear. So there really has to be some back and forth between doing this and then looking for the signatures of these things back in the embryo, which I think really hasn't been done yet, but we couldn't even really initiate this line of research without the stem cells. And then sort of other molecular links that I think are quite difficult to study in the embryo, right? So here people have, you know, used these Fuchi reagents, which many of you may be familiar with, which mark the state of the cell cycle, to add and to look at differentiation and ask, the cells differentiate differently depending on the state of the cell cycle they're in, right? And so, and people found actually, you know, this is again only over the last couple of years, a really dramatic effect on differentiation depending on the cell cycle phase. So cells really like to differentiate when they're in G1. If you hit them with a differentiating signal, they'll respond much better if they're already in G1. And whether they're in early G1 or late G1 actually influences what cell fate they become. And these are sort of a remarkable set of experiments that I can't imagine how you would do in sort of an intact embryo. But I think, you know, it's important to now look back at the embryos, right? You can make embryos with these Fuji markers and say, do we really see any signatures of this in the embryo, or is this just some weird thing that happens in cell culture? My interest, and what I'll talk about a lot more next week, is in understanding these kind of patterning mechanisms and signaling dynamics with stem cells. And there's been some history of this, and this is also sort of to strike a note of caution with how careful you have to be with this experiment. So this is an older paper where people, I think one of the first papers, where people use sort of a stem cell culture thing to say something about the embryo. And the unfortunate thing is, it turns out what they said about the embryo was totally wrong. They looked at these aggregates of mouse embryonic stem cells called embryoid bodies, and they formed these cavities, which they said are superficially similar to this cavity that formed in the mouse embryo. And they looked at the mechanism by which this forms, and they found that the cells in the middle are just dying, right? And they hypothesized that there's basically some survival signals coming from the outside that allow some ring of cells to survive, and the cells that are not within reach of the survival signal just wither up and die, and that generates these things. And so this is probably true in this embryoid body system, but people have returned to look at this much more carefully, and they found that these lumens don't get generated like that at all. They actually get generated, and you can generate them with a very small amount of cells through a process of sort of growing this epithelial layer with a lumen inside that has a completely different molecular mechanism. Right, so there's nothing wrong with the analysis of the embryoid bodies in the paper. You know, large embryoid bodies really do this, but what these lumps of thousands of cells are doing to make this cavity actually turned out to have nothing to do with, you know, what a system of, say, 50 cells is doing to make a cavity in the middle. And so, again, one really has to be careful about how one thinks about these things. People have now started to look at sort of gastrulation stage patterning, right? So here's some lumps of mouse stem cells that express a brachyury GFP reporter and a Wnt reporter, and they see these sort of localized expression domains that tend to correlate. So they're sort of making some rudimentary, what they like to call an AP axis. I'm not totally convinced that that's a real AP axis, but at least some asymmetries in these things that are developing from something symmetric. Of course, my own work has looked into how to take things. How to take things like this, right, where you have some pattern, but you can see it's incredibly heterogeneous. And right, how does one sort of start to think about studying these patterning mechanisms and come up with ways to confine the cells and make it more homogeneous so we can really define reproducible expression domains and then start to get at these systems to dissect the mechanisms of embryonic patterning. So I'll talk about that a lot more this week. That's all I wanted to say today. So thank you.
You were saying that eventually that all stem cells are by default neural cells unless there's some sort of inhibitors trying to stop them from developing neurons.
I guess it depends how you define an inhibitory pathway.
Well, right?
Unless there has to be some active pathway maintaining the stem cell state. And if you remove those signals, the cells will differentiate to neural cells.
It's almost that by default they want to become.
Yes. So people call the neural fate the default fate.
And do we know why that would be the case in terms of cause evolution and direction? Why it's just from that sort of.
You're going to disagree with something I just said.
I'm disagreeing in the sense that we all know from Spelman's work that you can get those cells
after you
use them. In an embryo.
But the induction comes from the secretion of inhibitors, right? So, right, the Spelman organizer secretes these cordon and noggin, it kills the BMP signals that would naturally be present in the ectoderm, and you do that. So the thinking, I think, is that when you dissociate these cells, right, you no longer need those inhibitors anymore. So the pluripotent or stem cell fate has to be actively maintained. So why cells would default to neurons as opposed to anything else? I don't know. I've never seen anyone publish a theory of that, but it appears to be quite well conserved, right, all the way.
Which means there must be an evolutionary reason why.
I don't know that.
So the question is, in order to achieve a particular cell type, are there many trajectories, differentiation trajectories, are there many different cocktails that can take you to this cell type, or it's only one possible way? In other words, how can you achieve different cell states? Are there many different roads to Rome, or?
That's a good question. So at the level of protocol, there are certainly many different roads, right? So I can take my culture, I dump in BMP, I get a lot of, you know, mesoderm, say. I can dump in Wnt instead and get mesoderm that looks of a similar character. Now, what's happening in the cells themselves, right, is not as clear, right? Because I have this positive feedback loop between BMP and Wnt, and so maybe, right, in theory, if you have these three pathways turning each other all on, maybe it doesn't matter which one you turn on, you kick on the feedback loop and it's sort of roughly the same thing, right? So we know a lot about recipes for making stem cells do particular things. And there's certainly, Lab A will have their latest, greatest recipe for making endoderm, and you look at Lab B and they're making the same character of endoderm and their recipe looks different often. But nobody really has gone into the cells to look at the signaling trajectories that they're experiencing on the way to becoming endoderm and ask whether they're the same, right? So I think it's possible that there's some sort of canalization at the level of signaling that we can do lots of different stuff to the cells that sort of pushes them in that direction, but then the cells are sort of forced to respond in similar ways, or at least the sort of variables that are important are forced to be similar. But that data is just not there, so we don't really know.